says, "Thank you, Jack," but Libby broke the rules as well. As we leave, I try to say, "I'm sorry," again, but Libby's father wraps his arm around her shoulders and steers her away. In the parking lot, my mom says, "We'll discuss this at home, Jack Henry." My full name. Something she hasn't called me in years. She drives off without another word. I go directly to Maslin's, hoping to slink in and bypass everyone, namely my dad. I'm barely settled behind the office desk when he comes walking in.
"I heard what happened today. What the hell were you thinking?"
I tell him I don't know, that it was meant to be a prank, but it ended up being a really stupid idea, and I wish I hadn't done it. And all the other things I've spent the past few hours saying over and over.
"Your mother and I are disappointed in you."
As if he needs to tell me this. I want to say, "I'm disappointed in you too." But instead I say, "I know. I'm sorry." When I'm finally alone, I turn on my phone. It immediately blows up with voicemails and texts. There's Caroline, Seth, Bailey, Bishop, Cam, and about 100 other people, including Marcus, who know all about what happened. Bailey Bishop is crying because she can't believe I would do something so hurtful to another human being. Caroline talks mostly about herself, but my brother actually wants to know if I'm okay and what happened with the principal. Cam's message says, "Congrats, princess. You win. Choose the place so we can take your sorry ass out for a victory meal. But hey, do me a favor, and don't get your ass kicked by any other girls before then." Followed by an entire minute of laughter.
Libby. The radio is playing, but the volume is low, and my dad is talking on and on. When he brings up homeschooling again, I say, "You don't need to worry about me. I can take care of myself."
"You really punched him?"
"Right in the mouth." And then he laughs. "Are you laughing?"
"I think I am."
"You're not supposed to laugh. You're supposed to tell me violence never solves anything and take away my phone or something."
"Don't punch anyone again. And if it makes you feel better, give me your phone."
And he just keeps on laughing. And now I'm laughing too. And for the first time in a long time, I feel normal. Weird as that sounds, we feel normal, which makes me think what happened today wasn't so bad after all, and maybe all the humiliation and the upcoming hours of community service and counseling are worth this single moment. As we pull up to our house, Dad says,
"Don't let that boy get in your head. Don't let him take away what you've worked so hard for."
"I won't. I'm getting up tomorrow and going back to school." I look down at my shoes and the quote written there. "You can't stop living."
Jack. I find Dusty in his room playing video games. He's got his headphones on, and I can hear the music blasting through them. The Jackson 5, which he only listens to when he's feeling his absolute worst. I wave at Dusty, and finally he looks up and mouths,
"What?"
I mime removing headphones. I make it elaborate and exaggerated, hoping he'll laugh. He ignores me. I start to dance. Dusty can't resist dancing. The song is Rockin' Robin, and I don't hold back. I just go for it. I'm twisting and grooving across the floor. I'm in a music video. I'm Michael Jackson in his prime. I am the man. "I'm the man," I say, loud enough so he can hear. I shake out the lion fro, making it as big as possible.
"You're not the man,"
he says it too loud, the way you always do when you're listening to the Jackson 5 at full volume through headphones.
"I am the man."
I'm doing dance moves, ones he taught me. I purposely do them wrong because he won't be able to help himself. He makes me sweat it for another 30 seconds, and then he's up and the headphones are off, and he starts showing me the correct steps. We finish the song, dancing in unison, and it's awesome. But then the song is over, and Dusty drops onto his bed and gives me this look that lets me know we're only in unison on the dance floor, nowhere else. Just to drive the point home, he goes,
"You're not the man."
I guess not. I sit next to him and we both stare at the floor.
"So, which is it? Which reason made you do this shitty thing?"
I think through all the reasons I listed before. Sometimes they're just shitty people. Sometimes people have been shitty to them. Sometimes they're shitty because they're afraid. Sometimes they choose to be shitty to others before others can be shitty to them. Sometimes someone doesn't like who he is, but then here's this other kid who knows exactly who he is, and that can make that first kid feel even worse about himself. Maybe all of them. But I meant what I said. I'll never be shitty to you. Then he looks at me, and he might as well knock me in my split lip, because he goes,
"You need to make it right."
I know.
Libby. My dad finds me in the kitchen eating standing up, and this is something we don't do anymore. It's one of the food rules we follow, along with don't eat in front of the TV, don't eat too fast, and stop eating when you're 60% full. When I see him, I set the plate down. Wherever the ache is coming from, my heart, my stomach, the food isn't reaching it. When my mom went away, I went empty too, like all of me just flooded out and disappeared. In the hospital, I held her hand until my grandmother came in, and my dad, and the rest of my family. All of them sweet and loving and brokenhearted, but none of them like my mom. Not even all together. They didn't begin to add up to her. My dad's eyes go to the plate, but he doesn't comment. Instead, he says, "Bailey Bishop is here to see you." Bailey stands in the center of my bedroom, head turning, hair catching the light like it's trying to grab all of it and keep it for itself. "It's been a long time." She leans down to rub George under his chin, and surprisingly, he lets her. "Traitor," I think. Bailey says, "Didn't you have him back then?" "I got him when I was 8. My mom and I picked him out, or rather, he picked us. We went to a rescue event, and George got free of his cage and packed himself into my mom's purse. He was supposed to die 4 years ago, but he's not ready. The last time Bailey was at my house, we were 10. I had invited her and Monique Benton and Giselle Villegas for a sleepover. The four of us stayed up all night and talked about boys and told each other our deepest, darkest secrets. Bailey's was that she tried to give her baby brother away when he was born. Mine was that I sometimes spied on the boys who lived across the street. This was before Dean, Sam, and Castiel became my only friends. Bailey straightens and focuses all of her Baileyness on me and says, "I'm sorry I never came to see you. I should have come to see you when you were in here. Well, not in here, but in your old house." This throws me completely, and I stand there like a lump. How does she get to be so nice and also have hair like that? Finally, I go, "That's okay. I mean, we weren't best friends or anything. But we were friends. I should have come." Should I hug her? Should I tell her it's okay? Should I tell her she should have come to see me a long time ago, way before I was trapped in my house, when my dad first pulled me out of school and let me stay home? She says, "I have to tell you something, and it's horrible, but I don't want you to have to hear about it at school." All of a sudden, she looks like she's going to cry, and at first I think she's going to tell me she's dying, or maybe I'm dying. And then she tells me about the game, how I was the grand prize in something called Fat Girl Rodeo, and how that news has spread across social media like a virus. Everyone is infected, and my 2,000 classmates and many, many strangers are all weighing in, get it? About whether they're Team Libby or Team Jack. Someone's posted a picture of me, which they must have snapped just after it happened, because there I am in the cafeteria, looking mad as a hatter, fist still clenched. Jack Maslin sprawled at my feet. You can't see his face, but you can see mine. Dangerously red, slightly sweaty.
Caption: Don't mess with Mad Libs. Libs, spelled LBS, as in pounds, of course.
There are 76 comments, and only a few of them are nice. The rest say the usual. If I was that big, I'd want to kill myself. And, she's pretty for a fat girl. And, just looking at her makes me want to never eat again. And simply, lose weight, you fat whore. This is exactly why I don't do social media. So many mean comments and snarky comments and bullying disguised as, I'm only expressing my opinion as the Constitution of our great country requires me to do. If you don't like it, don't read it, blah, blah, blah. I have this overwhelming urge to throw Bailey's phone away and my phone away and then go up and down the street collecting phones so I can throw them away too. Bailey says, maybe I shouldn't have said anything. She chews on a fingernail and squints up her eyes, and I can see the tears in them. I'm glad you did. I mean, I'm not happy, obviously, but I was going to find out somehow, and being told by the world's kindest person is probably the best way to do that. I turn my phone off, and then I shut down the computer so I can't read about myself anymore. I say to Bailey, I am sick of reading about myself. She nods in her eager to please Bailey way. I start pacing, which means I'm about to start talking. A lot. For one thing, there's only so much new material you can get from the fact that I'm overweight. We get it, people. Move on. Bailey nods like crazy. We get it. And this whole pretty for a fat girl thing, I mean, what is that? Why can't I just be pretty, period? I wouldn't say, oh, Bailey Bishop, she's pretty for a skinny girl. I mean, you're just Bailey, and you're pretty. Thank you. You're pretty, too. And unlike Caroline and Kendra, I know she means it. And what is this whole fat girl equals whore bullshit? She flinches. Sorry. Fat girl equals whore garbage. What is that? Why am I automatically a whore? How does that even make sense? It doesn't. If everyone who had something to say about me spent as much time on, I don't know, practicing kindness or developing a personality or a soul, imagine how lovely the world would be. So lovely. I go on and on, Bailey as my cheerleader, until I run out of steam. I sink down onto my bed and say, why are people so concerned with how big I am? She doesn't answer. Just takes my hand and holds it. She doesn't need to answer because there is no answer. Except that only small people, the inside small kind, don't like you to be big.
Jack. I've never built a robot before, but I'm determined. I watch a couple of YouTube videos, consult a couple of books. By the time I'm done, I've decided it's going to be the best damn Lego robot ever. For my 8th birthday, I asked for a hammer, screwdrivers, and wire cutters. I got my first soldering iron when I was 9. No one knows where this urge to build comes from, except that my dad has always been pretty handy, so maybe I get some of it from him. I just know that ever since I was little, making things out of thin air is what centers me. Like the way other people turn to yoga or morphine. It's why we have a pizza oven and a pitching machine in our backyard, a catapult in our garage, and a weather station on the roof. When I'm working, I see the object as a whole before it ever exists, and I build my way there. It's the exact opposite of my everyday life. But right now, all I see are the pieces, which is exactly like my everyday life. Red ones here, blue ones there, white and yellow and green and black. At some point, I lie back on top of them, right on the cold concrete floor. It's uncomfortable as hell, but I tell myself, you don't deserve comfort, asshole. I wonder what Libby Strout is doing right about now. I hope she's not thinking about me or today. I hope somehow she can think about something else, anything else. I hear footsteps on the basement stairs, and a woman appears. First her legs, then the rest of her. I assume it's my mom, because what other woman would be in the house? Unless Dad's decided to bring Monica Chapman in here. I look for the identifiers. This is Mom with hair down. Her mouth is wide. She's clearly black. I try to build my way to her face. But even after I locate enough pieces to tell myself, okay, that's her, it's not as if the image of her snaps into place for me. And it's not as if it sticks around. I suddenly feel old and so, so tired. It's exhausting, constantly having to search for the people you love. She says, I don't need to tell you how disappointed I am in you, or how angry. You do not. I look up at her from the floor. We have to hope they don't decide to press charges. You may not see yourself as black, and you may not think people see you as black, but it's a fact that our society treats kids of color more severely than others. And I do not want this following you for the rest of your life. We're both quiet as I think about my dismal dead-end future. She says, what are you doing? I was preparing to build a Lego robot for little man, but right now I'm contemplating what an asshole I am. That's a start. How are you going to make this better? I don't think there's any making it better, is there? There's just making it as good as I can after the fact. Is there anything you want to talk about? Anything you need to tell me? Not tonight. Maybe not ever. My phone buzzes on the floor next to me. Get your call. You can tell me tomorrow. Maybe. She adds, I love you anyway. I love you anyway, too.
Libby. It's almost 9 when Bailey leaves. I'm still fired up, so I dance for a while, and then I decide to do homework. I dump the contents of my backpack onto my bed and sort through my papers and notebooks and pens and gum wrappers and all the miscellaneous rubbish I've stuffed in there, including We Have Always Lived in the Castle, which I carry everywhere. Buried in the mess is a white letter-size envelope. What's this? I rip it open and start reading. I'm not a shitty person, but I'm about to do a shitty thing. At first, I think he's making it up. I read the letter again, and again. You know how it's easy to believe everything is about you, especially when something goes wrong? Why me? Why do I have the worst luck ever? Why is the universe so mean? Why does everyone hate me? My mom used to say sometimes it's actually about the other person and you just happen to be there. Like sometimes the other person needs to learn a lesson or go through an experience, good or bad, and you're just an accessory in some way, like a supporting actor in whatever their scene happens to be. Maybe, just maybe, this whole nightmare is more about Jack Maslin than it is about me. Maybe this whole thing happened to teach him a lesson about how to treat other people. I sit and think on that for a while. This was the thing Mom did. Looked at all sides of things. She believed that situations and people were almost never black and white. 10 minutes later, I'm reading everything I can find on prosopagnosia, which leads me to an artist named Chuck Close, neurologist/author Oliver Sacks, and Brad Pitt. According to the internet, they all have face blindness. I mean, Brad Pitt. What if the entire world was face blind? If everyone had prosopagnosia, there'd be hope for the homely. No one would ever say, you're too pretty to be fat, or she's pretty for a fat girl, because looks would stop mattering. Would people still care if you were overweight or too thin? Tall or short? Maybe. Maybe not. But it would be a step in the right direction. At fat camp, we had to try to put ourselves into the skin of other people, Just like Atticus told Scout, you never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view. Until you climb inside of his skin and walk around in it. Skin's so fascinating anyway. I mean, the way it expands and shrinks. I used to weigh twice what I do now. That's 2 times more. And my skin fit me then, and it fits me now. Weird. I try to put myself in Jack Maslin's skin and imagine what he sees when he looks at me. Do I look different in some way from everyone else? Or do I blend in? Then I imagine that I'm the one with face blindness. What would the world look like? I pull up a new document. I write, Dear Jack, thanks for explaining your douchiness. I don't think prosopagnosia gives you the right to be a jerk, but I'm at least glad you're not rotten to your core. Maybe there's hope for you. Libby. P.S. I have questions.
Jack. On the other end of the phone, Cam says,
I wish you could have seen it. The look on her face when you threw yourself around her, and then when you just hung out there and wouldn't let go.
I force out this kind of half-hearted laugh that sounds like I'm being strangled.
Man, I bet she looked surprised. As surprised as that chicken psycho when Norman Bates interrupts her shower.
So what did Wasserman say?
Oh, she was really fucking thrilled. Community service and counseling. For weeks.
Shit.
I know. But it was worth it. Says the man who doesn't have to do it.
He's laughing again.
But wait. It gets better.
Great.
Remember the girl who got cut out of her house a couple of years ago?
What about her?
That's her.
Who?
Libby Strout. She's the one you rodeoed.
I feel like I've been punched in the face again.
Are you sure?
I try to sound like I don't really give a shit, but here's the thing. I do give a shit. I give 5 million shits, which is why I feel like I'm going to be sick all over these Legos.
Oh, I'm sure.
He's laughing. I do my strangle laugh again, only it sounds worse this time.
Man, you sound rough.
I think she broke my throat.
So do you remember her?
Yeah, I do. Outside, the neighborhood is asleep. I climb out my window and into the tree that acts as a ladder to the roof. I snake all the way up it until I'm there. And then I walk to the edge over by the gutter. My weather station is anchored near the chimney, battered and lopsided. When I was 6, I fell off the roof and cracked my head open. Without thinking, I reach up to feel the scar. I run my fingers along it as I stare across the street. If I stand here long enough, I can see it. The gaping hole where the front wall of her house used to be.
3 years earlier.
Jack, age 14. I dream that the street's on fire. And then I wake up to sirens. I lie still and listen as they come blaring toward the house. It's end of days dark in here, but suddenly the ceiling flashes red, and the sirens whine to a stop. I'm up and out of bed and grabbing shit off my dresser and bookshelves before I even know what's happening. On my way out, I fall headfirst into the hallway, where I hear but don't see my dad, who says from the black recesses of his bedroom,
It's not us. Go back to bed.
But the dream was so damn real that I'm still half in it, and I keep right on going. Outside, the air is cold but smells clean. No fire, no smoke. I'm still holding the shit I grabbed, my granddad's watch, my retainer, stack of baseball cards, my phone charger, but no phone, and of course there's no jacket. It's the house across the street. Rolling up in front is this line of fire trucks, an ambulance, 2 police cars. I figure it must be drug lords or a meth lab or maybe even a terrorist. I think it would be really damn cool to have a terrorist on our street because Amos, Indiana is one boring ass place. Whose house is that? It's Mom behind me.
Strom? Stein?
This from Dad.
Strout,
says Marcus, who's 12, almost 13, and knows everything. I say before he can, the Strouts moved out years ago. The house has been empty since then. You never see anyone coming or going.
No, they didn't.
My other brother, Dusty, 7, is hopping on one leg.
Tams and me went over last week and looked in the windows.
Dusty. Mom shakes her head.
What? We wanted to see the fat girl.
We don't say fat. It's not polite.
Teacher says fat is an adjective, just like beautiful or handsome. It's only people that make it a bad word by saying, listen up, fatso, or hey, look at that fat ass.
Mom frowns at my dad like, he's your fault. And he says,
Dustin,
in a warning tone. But I can tell he's trying not to laugh. I say, Mrs. Buckley? Dusty stares up at me, still on one leg. He nods, I nod. That's about right. Mrs. Buckley is a very large woman.
Jack,
Mom sighs. My mom is always sighing. Let's go. Back inside. It's cold. You've got school tomorrow. If we don't stop her, she'll list 101 reasons why we need to get off this lawn. Just then another fire truck comes roaring up, siren blaring. And then this white truck comes lumbering along behind. And this one's pulling a crane. A crane. We watch in silence as the firefighters and police and these construction workers, who suddenly seem to be everywhere, set up giant spotlights. The front door to the house opens and closes, and people are moving like ants, scrambling across the yard and disappearing inside and blocking off the street. By now, all the lights on the street are on, and every lawn is covered with gawkers. We're directly across from it all. Front row seats. A man walks toward us, hands in pockets, glancing over his shoulder at all the commotion. He says to me,
can you believe this?
He nods over at the house. I really can't, I say. And then Dad goes,
I thought that house was empty.
He says it to the man, who falls in beside him, and they stand side by side watching. There's an ease to it that makes me think my dad must know him. And then my mom calls the man Greg and asks about his daughter Jocelyn, the one at Notre Dame. And that's how I know it's Mr. Wallen, our next-door neighbor. I stand there surrounded by the fire trucks and the spotlights and that giant crane, ruminating on my brain and how it's so weirdly, strangely different from Marcus's or Dusty's or the brain of anyone else I know. It's so weirdly, strangely different that for the past year, I've been writing about it. Not my life story, but a sort of, this is me, this is what I think log, because I like to understand how things work. Other brains are simple and uncomplicated, and there's room in them for Mr. Wallen and his daughter Jocelyn, whereas my brain seems to be made for bigger things. Baseball, physics, aeronautical engineering, maybe president. This is the reason I don't watch a lot of TV or movies. I tell myself my brain is too busy thinking important things to keep track of the characters. I watch as a news van rolls in, all the way from Indianapolis, and think again, terrorists. I mean, what else could it be?
Libby, age 13. It's the feeling of being suffocated. What being strangled must be like. My world has tilted away and gone light and floaty. And maybe it's actually more like floating in space. I try to move my head, my arms, my legs, but I can't. When I was little, my mom read me this story about a girl who lived in a garden and was never allowed outside the walls. The garden was all she knew, and to her, that was the whole world. I'm thinking about this girl now as I'm trying to breathe. I see my dad's face, but he looks 100 years away. Like I'm circling the moon and he's down on Earth. And I'm trying to remember the name of the story. I suddenly need to remember. This is what happens when people die. They start to disappear if you don't watch it. Not all at once, but a piece here, a piece there. Think. The father was Italian. Rappaccini. Rappaccini's daughter. Did the girl have a name? I try to raise my head so I can ask my dad, but he says, "Stay very still," from way down on Earth. "Help is coming, Libby." Not Libby, I think. Rappaccini's daughter. I'm here in my garden, and the world has stopped, and my heart has stopped. And I am all alone. Then I hear something that brings me back to this planet, this town, this neighborhood, this street, these four walls. The sound of the garden being torn away. The sound of my world crumbling.
Jack, age 14. 5 hours later, the top half of the house has been demolished by a team of sledgehammers and circular saws. The emergency workers have erected scaffolding and a long, wide bridge up to the second floor window. They fitted supports to keep the roof from collapsing, and when the sun comes up, they unroll this black tarp and circle the house with it. For privacy, I guess. It's clear that something needs to come out of there, and whatever it is, it's big. I sit on our roof so I can see right over the tarp. An enormous stretcher. I'm not sure what else to call it, is hauled out of the truck and rolled up onto the bridge. The emergency workers are racing back and forth, and a handful of them anchor the stretcher in place. And then the crane goes cranking forward and reaches its claw into the bowels of the house. The tree outside my bedroom window suddenly starts to shake, and a head appears. This skinny little kid pulls himself up next to me. "Move over," he says. I make room for him, and together we sit there. We watch as the claw comes up and out, and inside the claw is a pair of arms and a pair of legs.
"Is she dead?"
Dusty whispers. "I don't know." The arms start waving and the legs begin kicking. It's like King Kong clutching Andaro. "Not dead," I say. The crane sweeps around till it's above the bridge, and all that scaffolding, and then lowers itself over the stretcher. Very gently, like it's playing a game of pickup sticks, the crane releases the arms and legs until I can see that they belong to a girl. The largest girl I've ever seen.
"Told you,"
Dusty says.
Libby, age 13. The sky is bright and blinding. It's like I've never seen it before. And oh, it's so beautiful. And I'm alive. I'm alive. If I die right now, at least I've seen the sky like this, all blue and brilliant and new. My chest is still clenching, but some of the clenching releases, and it's because these nice men and women are here, and I'm not dead, and I'm not going to die in there, in that house. Not to say I won't die here in the yard, but at least the air is fresh, and I can breathe, and there are trees, and sky, and birds, and over there a cloud. A fluffy one, and there is the smell of something. Flowers, maybe. I want to say, "Look at me, Dean, Sam, Cass, I'm out here just like you." And then I think how they're my only friends, even though they don't know it. And oh my God, I'm crying again. But then I must pass out because when I wake up, I'm being bumped all around, and I'm in the back of a truck, not even an ambulance like a regular person. I stare up at dingy metal instead of blue, and all at once I feel humiliated. How many people did it take to break me out? I try to ask my dad, who sits back against the rattling metal wall, head jostling up and down, but his eyes are closed, and I can't speak, and suddenly I think, what if I never speak again? Dad opens his eyes and sees me staring at him, and he smiles, but he's not fast enough. My chest is clenching tighter and tighter, and I don't want to be here in this truck. I want to be in my bed, in my room, in my house. I don't want to be out here, in this world. I want to say, take me home, please, if there's anything left of it. But then something sweeps over me. And it's this kind of quiet, peaceful feeling. And that's her. That's my mom. I breathe slower, to try to make it last, to try to keep her with me. Live, 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 live. I think it as hard as I can before everything goes black. And as I drift off, I remember. Rappaccini's daughter. Beatrice. Her name was Beatrice.
Jack, age 14. When I get home from school that day, a security vehicle is parked in front, and a guard sits behind the wheel, sound asleep. I check to see if anyone is looking, and then I walk right in. There's only half a living room. The sofa is oversized and drooping in the middle like a hammock. A framed picture lies face up on the floor, and it's of a man and a woman and a little girl. The girl is out of focus, and you can tell she's laughing. In the photo, she's just a regular-sized kid. The kitchen is a typical kitchen. For the most part, it's intact, only a little dust. I go to the fridge first because I can't help it. I want to see what's in there. I expect a banquet suitable for Henry VIII, but it's just your run-of-the-mill stuff. Eggs, milk, deli meat, cheese, diet sodas, juice. On the outside of the door is a single magnet. Ohio welcomes you. I walk through the whole house. It's smaller than ours, and it doesn't take me long to find her bedroom, even though part of the front wall is missing. I don't go in because it doesn't feel respectful. Instead, I stand in the doorway. The walls, the ones that are left, are lavender, and there are bookshelves, floor to ceiling, on every single one. The books look like they might spill out and overtake the room, maybe the whole house. The bed is the focal point of the room and looks specially built. It's a king-size bed that pretty much fills all the space. It sits on top of this metal, steel platform, and beside it is a single pair of slippers. It's the slippers that get me. They look delicate, like they were made for a girl Dusty's age. The sheets have daisies on them, and they're thrown all around, as if a tornado's blown through. One of the pillows lies on the floor. A stack of books sits by the bed, and it takes me a second to see that these are 6 copies of the same book. We Have Always Lived in the Castle, by Shirley Jackson. Although the bindings are different. I think she must really love that book. When I leave, I try not to touch anything except for one copy of the Shirley Jackson book and the Ohio magnet, both of which I take. I don't know why. Maybe it makes me feel closer to the girl who lives there. Outside, the guard is still sleeping, and I rap on the glass to wake him up. When he rolls down the window, I say, "Stay alert, buddy. I imagine everything they own is in that house, and they've been through enough without losing it to looters." Of course, the book and magnet don't count. I knock on the door of Marcus's room and then walk on in. His walls are covered with posters, mostly of basketball players. There's a hoop attached to the closet door. A gangly, shaggy-haired kid hunches on the floor in front of his computer. He's playing a video game, the shoot-everyone-and-blow-shit-up kind. I do what I usually do.
Look for the signs that this is my brother. The pointy chin, the messy hair, the mopey expression. I look for the pieces and put them together because this is how I know it's him. Can I ask you a question?
What?
He doesn't take his eyes off the screen. How do you remember people so well? How do you tell them apart?
What?
Take Squinty. Her name's Patrice. Whatever, Patrice. How do you pick her out of a crowd?
She's my girlfriend?
I know she's your girlfriend. Do you know what she'd do to me if I couldn't pick her out of a crowd?
Yeah,
but what is it about her that tells you it's her? He pauses the game, stares at me for like a whole minute.
I just look at her.
I just know. What's wrong with you? Have you gone crazy? My eyes move past him to the walls of basketball players. I want to ask him if he can tell them apart without their jersey numbers or names on the back. When I look at him again, he's still staring at me. Only his features have shifted so that he's brand new. I say, never mind. I'm just messing with you. I go back into my room and dig out the old composition notebook I keep hidden away in a drawer and start flipping through it. This is where I sort out the projects I build, drawing them, planning them out. But in between the brainstorms and sketches and blueprints and lists of materials needed, there are passages like these. Went to Claire's Pizza with the family. Got lost coming back from bathroom. Took me a while to find them. Dad finally had to wave me down. I was so wiped out after Saturday's game, we won in straight innings, I didn't even recognize DeMario Raines when he came up to congratulate me. Every few pages, entry after entry. Nothing earth-shattering or alarming until you start adding them up. As I'm reading them now, a feeling settles over me like a blanket. But not the warm, comforting kind. More like a thick and scratchy blanket thrown over the head just before you're shoved into the trunk of a car. There is something wrong with me. Of all the people in the world, I feel like the girl would understand. I sit there the rest of the night thinking, I hope she makes it. And even though the news is protecting her identity, and all I know is her last name, I write her a letter to tell her this. Tuck it into her favorite book, and go online to find the mailing address for the local hospital.
Libby, age 13. Dr. Weiss is thin and tall, and probably couldn't gain weight if he tried. He's worried I'm trying to kill myself. I tell him, if I wanted to kill myself, there are faster ways to do it. He stands beside my hospital bed with his arms crossed. His face is hard to read because he does this thing where he can frown and smile at the same time. He says,
your father says you've been housebound for 6 months.
It depends on when you start counting. For 5 months and 24 days, I've been too large to get through the door. But my last day of school was 2 years ago.
There are two important things we need to understand here. Why you had this panic attack and why you gained the weight. That's what we need to address. It will be a process, and it will take time. But we are going to get you healthy again.
I glance at my dad in the armchair across from me. He knows as well as I do what the why is. It's everything changing when I was 10. It's the bullying and the fear. So much fear of everything, but mostly death. Sudden, out of the blue death. It's also me being terrified of life. It's the giant emptiness in my chest. It's touching my face or my skin and feeling nothing. This is the why of me staying home in the first place. And the why of me eating. And the why of me ending up here. But that doesn't mean I want to die. On the day before I leave the hospital, the nurse brings me a package. No return address. Most everyone else is sending me letters, not packages, which is the only reason I open it. That, and the fact that my dad isn't here to take it away before I can. Inside is a handwritten note without a name or signature, and a copy of my favorite book. One of my actual very own copies of my favorite book, with my initials on the cover and my highlights throughout. I thought you might want this. Unlike the other letters, this one is nice. I want you to know I'm rooting for you. For the first time in a long time, I touch my skin and feel something. When Rachel Mendez, tutor and caregiver, arrives, I lay the book down and tell her the thing I've been wanting to say but no one will hear. I pull up one of the news articles on my new phone, my first phone, the one my dad bought me so I can call him if I need anything. I enlarge the picture of me taken the day I was rescued from our house. This girl, I tell Rachel, that's not what I look like. That's not who I am. I have a feeling Rachel will get this because she pretended to be straight all through high school, even though she figured out she was a lesbian when she was in eighth grade. I say it again. That's not me. Her eyes light up. Great. Let's see if we can find her. Now. Libby. I throw open my locker before first period and something flutters out and lands on my shoe. It's a piece of paper folded in thirds. I stare at it for a while because it's been my experience that pieces of paper folded in thirds are not a good thing. I finally pick it up and hold it inside my locker where no one will see. America's fattest teen rescued from house. It's an article from the internet, and there I am, in a blurry photo, being wheeled across the front lawn by emergency workers. On the other side is a giant picture of my giant face taken yesterday in the cafeteria. Beside it, someone's written, "Congratulations on being voted MVB High's fattest teen." I close the door and rest my forehead against the metal of the locker, because my head is going hot, and I feel dizzy, which is sometimes how it starts. Is this what she felt the day she drove herself to the hospital? Is this how it began for her? The metal cools me for only a second, but then it's hotter than my skin and I'm worried I'll burn myself. I concentrate on lifting my head till it's sitting upright on my neck once again. The hallway tilts. I open the locker door and focus on the jacket hook, my books, my little corner of the universe. I breathe. In first period, Mick from Copenhagen is talking to me, but I'm too busy to listen because I'm writing my resignation letter from school. Dear Principal Wasserman, thank you so much for this educational opportunity. Unfortunately, I will not be able to continue here at MVB High because it is overrun by imbeciles. I cross this out and write, because of an unfortunate epidemic of imbeciles. Unfortunate epidemic of imbecility? I say to Mick from Copenhagen. Which sounds better to you? An unfortunate epidemic of imbeciles or an unfortunate epidemic of imbecility? Or do you think it sounds stronger to say a place is overrun by imbeciles? He laughs, and lines like the sun's rays frame the corners of his eyes. Libby Strout, I'm amazed by you. You turned the hell out of me on. At least that's one person.
Jack. As far as days go, this is pretty much the worst one ever. You think it's funny to harass women? You think bullying is funny? Eating disorders aren't funny, asshole. I want to go. The whole reason I fucking did this was not to piss you people off. I'm also getting a lot of, that was hilarious, you're fearless, man. Good one, dude, you're awesome. And? Nice lip mass. What's the other guy look like? Oh wait, the other girl. Hey Maslin, don't piss off, insert name of tiny freshman girl. She might kick your ass. The only good news is that I can't tell who's yelling things at me,
as they pass me in the hall. Caroline Luchamp holds my hand between first and second period, and when someone shouts at me, she says, "Just ignore them." Suddenly, she's the sweet Caroline of years ago, and I concentrate on the feel of her hand in mine.
Libby. Throughout the day, more printed out articles show up in my locker. I try to tell myself to look on the positive side. At least my peers are using the internet for something other than social media and porn. But honestly, it's not very comforting. By fourth period, it's clear that everyone, even the janitors, knows me as the girl who had to be cut out of her house. I'm Indiana's high school version of Typhoid Mary. In each class, I sit alone, like fatness is catching. Moons ago, when I was getting all that hate mail, my dad talked to an attorney who told us to hang on to everything just in case something terrible happened, like I was murdered. That way, there would be a paper trail to possible suspects. News reporter, do you feel worried? Do you fear for your safety? Me, you know, I'm glad you asked that. Maybe I should be scared right now, but I honestly think the people writing these letters need to be pitied more than feared. It's been my experience that the people who are most afraid are the ones who hide behind mean and threatening words. I stuff the articles in my backpack. I don't think anyone at MVB is planning to kill me, but you can never be too safe. I return to the cafeteria, even though this is the last place on earth I want to be. I walk in, and 600 heads turn at once. 600 mouths start buzzing. 1,200 eyes follow me as I walk. I feel my breath abandon ship like it's saying, "Every man for himself! Good luck to you, you're on your own!" I move on without it, taking one step, two steps, three steps. I'm counting them the way my trainers and counselors taught me to do. It is 37 steps to the round table by the window, where Iris, Bailey, and J.V. DeCastro are sitting. I clutch the back of the chair, and it feels so solid and comforting that I almost remain standing, gripping it with all my might. But then I lower myself into the seat and say, "Well, that was fun." Bailey says very low because, let's face it, the people around us are trying to listen. "I've known Jack Maslin since seventh grade, and I can't believe he would do this. I mean, okay, he's not exactly a model student, and there was that one time junior year, his junior year, our sophomore year, when he and Dave Kaminsky kidnapped a freshman and locked him on the roof outside the second floor boys' bathroom." "Walt Casey." JV shakes her head, and her bob makes a swish-swish sound. "Poor Walt." Iris freezes mid-sip. "What's wrong with Walt?" "He's just off." JV frowns across the cafeteria at a boy I assume must be poor Walt Casey, sitting by himself. As if he's trying to illustrate her point, he starts picking his nose. Bailey keeps right on. "But I mean, if you'd told me something like that happened and asked me to guess who was behind it, I never would have guessed Jack Maslin. Never. There are a lot of other people I would have guessed before him. Dave Kaminsky being one, and Seth Powell, and the Hunts, of course, and Reed Young, and Shane Ogas, and Sterling Emery." On and on, naming every boy in the history of the universe. "I think he's really sorry he did it." They look at me. "He wasn't thinking. He did this stupid thing, and he feels pretty bad about it." Iris goes, "You're defending him?" "I'm just crawling around inside his skin." JV says, "Atticus Finch." She holds up a hand so we can high five. "If it was me he did that to, I'd go super ninja on him." JV would go super ninja on anyone who pissed her off. "Haven't you ever done something you regretted?" I look right at Bailey. JV says, "Does last year's school picture count?" I poke at my food, at this lunch my dad so carefully prepared, and then shove it aside. I can't eat. Not in here where everyone is staring at me. Iris says, "Did you hear about Terry Collins? She's moving to Minnesota." JV's hair goes swish, swish, swish. "Poor Terry." I say, "She's a damsel, right?" JV holds up a finger. "Was."
Jack. In the cafeteria, Cam and Seth, and the other idiots I call friends, can't talk about anything else. Seth is giving those who missed it a play-by-play.
"Shit, Mass," one of the idiots says,
and you can hear the admiration in his voice. See it there on his face. I hitch up one corner of my mouth, as if I'm just too fucking cool to smile all the way, and hold up my hands like, "Whatever, man, all in a day's work. That's why I'm me and you're you, baby." I slap Seth 5 and go back to watching the large girl by the window, who I'm pretty sure is Libby Stroud. At some point, I feel Cam staring at me.
"What you looking at?"
"Nothing."
He turns and looks toward the window, hangs out there for a few seconds, then turns back to me.
"You know, sometimes I can't figure you out. Are you as dickish as the rest of us? Or is there a heart beating in that underdeveloped chest of yours?"
I fake grin. "I couldn't possibly be as dickish as the rest of you." And this is why I like Cam, in spite of himself. He's no dummy. And someday, about 15 or 20 years from now, he may even become a nice guy. Which is more than I can say for the rest of them. Seth and the others are congratulating me on how goddamn hilarious I am, and I'm feeling smaller and smaller, when a girl comes over, trailed by a group of girls, and they all look exactly the same. Same hair, same lip gloss, same clothes, same bodies. The leader goes, "Why don't you pick on someone your own size, Jack Maslin?" and empties her diet Snapple on my head. Someone yells, "Not the hair! Anything but the hair!" Laughter. I jump to my feet, dripping everywhere, and now people are applauding. The girl goes storming away, and Cam says to me,
"If you're only picking on people your own size, I'm afraid that's going to limit you to freshmen."
And then he pulls out his flask, unscrews the top, and, for the first time ever, offers it to me.
"I hope that's orange juice."
It's a woman's voice over my shoulder. I'm looking at Cam and he goes,
"Of course, Mrs. Chapman. Vitamin C is not only crucial to our development, it protects us from scurvy."
Monica Chapman shakes her head at Cam and then, in front of everyone, turns to me and goes,
"I wanted to make sure you're okay."
She's eyeing my wet clothes and the puddle of diet Snapple at my feet.
"I'm super. Thanks.
I know today can't be easy."
To her credit, she lowers her voice, but this actually makes it worse. Like she's conspiring with me. As if we're the ones with the secret.
"There's nothing that bonds people more than judging someone else. And even when we've done something wrong, it often doesn't warrant those judgments."
And now she's talking about her. Not me. I feel the rubber band compressing my cold, dead heart snap in two. And without a word, I'm out of there.
Libby. I escape outside into the fresh air and let out all the breath I've been holding for the past hour. You returned to the crime scene and you survived. Now that I can breathe again, it's coming in a rush. And I feel dizzy from so much oxygen in my chest and in my brain. It's important I keep my blood pressure low and steady. It's a matter of life and death. I am serious. Life and death. Because this could be how it starts. Soaring blood pressure, followed by dizziness, followed by goodbye, Libby. It can run in families. Like that. The time machine that lives in my head teleports me back to that day. I'm standing beside my mom's bed and wondering how something like this, her unconscious in that bed, could happen. She looks peaceful, my dad said on the ride to the hospital. Like she's sleeping. In the ICU, my mom was connected to all these tubes and wires and a machine was breathing for her. I didn't know what to do, so I sat by her and then I took her hand, and she was still warm, but not as warm as usual. I squeezed her fingers, but not too hard because I didn't want to hurt her. Her head was back, her eyes open, like she was just waking up. She didn't look peaceful. She looked empty. I said, I'm here. Please don't go. Please stay. Wake up. Please wake up. Please don't leave me. Please, please, please. If anyone can come back, it's you. Please come back. Please don't go. Please don't leave me alone. Because if she went away, that's what I would be. Outside the school, the sky is a mix of white and blue, but the cool air feels like a kiss against my hot, hot skin. I dig a marker out of my bag. I find a blank space on one sneaker. I write, "You just hold your head high and keep those fists down." Harper Lee, To Kill a Mockingbird. I tell my brain to focus on the good. The fact that no one tried to ride me like a bull in the cafeteria today. The fact that I seem to have three actual friends. And the fact that Terry Collins is moving to Minnesota. The damsels will need to replace her. Yet I can't seem to shake the feeling that everyone belongs here but me. I think about Mary Catherine Blackwood from We Have Always Lived in the Castle. I've always loved her and felt sorry for her because she's quirky and weird, just like me, and I've told myself, misunderstood. But right now, I have this unsettling someone's hiding in the closet feeling, like maybe I was wrong. Maybe it's better that she's locked away from the rest of the world. Maybe she's not cut out to live like other people with other people. Maybe she belongs in that house forever.
Jack. In the ocean of people, I see this very large girl coming toward me. And it's her, Libby Strout. A group of girls elbows each other, and even though they're whispering, I can hear them say something about Fat Girl Rodeo. They stare at Libby, and that's the moment it hits me. Square in the face. This is what I've done to her. Painted a giant red target on her back. As they're gawking, she stops in front of me and hands me a note. Here. This sends the girls into a giggling fit, and I can already hear the gossip mill churning.
Libby. After school, I walk down a flight of stairs off the main hall to the creepy basement, which is where the old basketball court is, the one they used years ago before they built a million-dollar sports complex that seats 10,000 people. Jack Maslin leans back on the bleachers, legs stretched in front of him, elbows propped on the riser behind him, chatting with Travis Kearns from Driver's Ed, a smiling girl with long brown hair, and a boy with a smooth-shaved head who I think is Kashawn Price, basketball star. They're hanging on Jack Maslin's every word, and he looks up, sees me, and keeps right on talking. Or maybe he doesn't see me, although I am the largest girl in here. I sit apart from them on the front row. This gym can fit probably 600, and there's something about it that feels sad and neglected, which of course it is. With every laugh coming from the group above me, I feel more and more invisible. Two other kids wander in, but I don't know their names. The girl sits next to me about a foot away, and the boy takes a seat one row up. The girl leans over and goes, "I'm Maddie." "Libby, is this the conversation circle?" But right then, Mr. Levine moseys in. "Hello, hello. Thank you all for being here today." He stops in front of the bleachers, hands on hips. He's wearing an orange bow tie and matching orange sneakers, and except for the gray hair, he looks like he could be one of us. He says, "Let's get this out of the way.
I'm not going to talk to you about the importance of tolerance, equality, and realizing that we're all in this together, because I don't think you're stupid and completely lacking moral fiber. I think you're smart individuals who did really stupid things. Who wants to start?
We all sit there. Even Jack Maslin goes silent. Mr. Levine keeps on.
How about, why are you here? The real reason. Not Principal Wasserman made me do this.
I'm waiting for someone to say something. When no one does, I say,
I'm here because of him, and point at Jack.
Mr. Levine shakes his head.
Actually, you're here because you vandalized school property, and because you punched him.
One of the guys goes,
Nice!
Jack says,
Shut up. Gentlemen, and I use that term loosely,
Mr. Levine says to me,
You could have walked away.
Would you have walked away?
I'm not the one he grabbed.
Okay, I take a breath. How about I'm here because I lost my temper? Because when someone grabs you out of the blue and won't let go, you panic, especially when everyone's watching you and no one's doing anything to help you, and everybody but you seems to think it's funny. I'm here because I didn't know if it stopped there or if he was going to do something more than just hold on. Everyone is staring at Jack. At me. Mr. Levine is nodding.
Jack, buddy, feel free to jump in.
I'm good.
That's what he says. I'm good. Lounging there with his bored expression and that giant explosion of hair, too full of himself to participate. If he doesn't have anything to say, I'll go again. If there's anything I'm good at in this world, it's being counseled. I've had years of it, and I know how to talk about myself and the whys of things, even in front of a room of strangers. Mr. Levine says,
Great. The floor is apparently all yours, Libby.
After they cut me out of my house, I was in the hospital for a while, and even when I was strong enough to go home, the doctor kept me there because he said I couldn't leave till I understood the why. Why I was there. Why did I gain all that weight? Mr. Levine doesn't interrupt, but you can tell he's really, truly listening. So is everybody else, even Travis Kearns. I keep talking because I've been over this 100 times, so much that it's barely a part of me anymore. It's just a truth that lives outside me in the world. Libby got too big. Libby was cut out of her house. Libby got help. Libby got better. If there's anything I've learned from counseling and losing my mom, it's that it's best to just say what's on your mind. If you try to carry everything around all the time, pretty soon you end up flat on your back in bed, too big to get up, or even turn over. So the why was a lot of things. It was inheriting my dad's Hulk-sized thighs and slow metabolism. It was being bullied on the playground. It was my mom dying and the way she died, and me being afraid, and me feeling alone and worrying, always worrying. And dad being sad, and dad loving food and loving to cook, and me wanting him to feel better, and also wanting me to feel better. I hear a, damn girl, from Kishan before Mr. Levine says,
Well done, Libby.
A couple of the kids applaud. Thank you. For some reason, this means something, not the applause, but Mr. Levine. What he thinks of me matters. I was housebound for a while, so I had a lot of time to think about it, and I've had a lot of time to think about it since. We all look at Jack, but he says nothing. Mr. Levine turns back to me.
So why did you punch him?
I want to go, look at him. He's perfect. He's never had a bad day. Okay, he has this strange disorder that keeps him from recognizing people, but no one's ever called him fat or ugly or disgusting. No one sent him hate mail or told him he would have been better off killing himself. His parents never received hate mail just for having him. Also, he has parents. I doubt he knows what it's like to lose someone he loves. People like us, we can't touch him because he's too good for you and me and the rest of these kids and this punishment. Not to mention his friends utterly suck. I want to say, why wouldn't I punch him? but I don't really have an answer other than, I was mad. And I know it's not enough because of the look on Mr. Levine's face. I've seen it before. It's the look counselors get when they analyze you, when they know the answer before you do. But they're not going to tell you, because you have to think of it yourself.
Jack. When it's my turn, I say, the real reason I'm here is because I'm King Douchelord of the Universe. The guy with the bow tie, who must be Mr. Levine, goes, in English, please, Jack. I hunch forward and stare at the floor. I look like I'm trying to come up with just the right words, which I am. But the main reason is so I can avoid eye contact. Sometimes I want to close my eyes and forget that I can see. Because sometimes being face blind feels a lot like being regular blind. Mr. Levine says, what's your why? I don't have a why. Only an oh shit and a what was I thinking. I crack a grin at him. And then I catch Libby's eye. I stare at her and she stares back. She's read my letter. She can out me right here. I wait for her to say something. When she doesn't, I clear my throat. For what it's worth, I wish I hadn't done it. It's the first honest thing I've said all day. Afterward, she finds me in the parking lot, half in the Land Rover, phone to my face. So when did you put it in there? What? The letter. I say into the phone, I'm going to have to call you back. And hang up on Caroline just as she goes, who are you talking to? I say to Libby, when I grabbed you. Did you think a letter was going to magically make everything okay? Did it? What do you think? You can't blame a guy for trying. I flash her a smile, but she shakes her head and waves a finger at my face. Don't do that. All right, let's be real then. You said you've got questions, ask me anything. My phone buzzes in my pocket. How long have you known about the face blindness? I figured it out around 14. It wasn't this kind of overnight revelation, though. It was more like this process. I had to put the clues together, so it took a while. So you can see my face, but you can't remember it? Something like that. It's not like faces are a blank. I see eyes, noses, mouths. I just can't associate them with specific people. Not like how you, as in Libby, can take a mental snapshot of someone and store it away in your mind for next time. I take a snapshot, and it immediately goes in the trash. If it takes you one or two meetings to be able to remember someone, it can take me 100. Or never. It's kind of like amnesia, or like trying to tell everyone apart by their hands. She glances down at her hands, and then at mine. So, when you turn away, and then you turn back, you're not sure who I am? Intellectually, I get that it's you, but I don't believe it, if that makes sense. I have to convince myself all over again. This is Libby. I know that sounds crazy. What's crazy is standing here talking about this to someone other than myself. Is it true it's hard to watch TV or movies because you can't keep the character straight? Like people, some shows and movies are harder than others. Monster movies and cartoons are easy. Crime shows aren't so much. I'm always wondering, where's the bad guy? And who the hell is that? I'm looking at her, and I'm charged with all this crazy, heart-pounding adrenaline. It's almost as if she's interviewing me, but I don't mind because it's the first time I've talked about this with anyone. And it's kind of feeling a lot like freedom. Like, here's a person who might actually be able to get who I am. How is it, you know, to have it? It's like having a circus in my mind and always jumping through hoops. It's like being in a crowded room where at first you don't know anyone. always? Her eyes go bright and kind of intense. Like coming back to school 5 years later and you're trying to figure out if you knew him or her or them. But everyone looks different. And so the people you knew before are just people? Right. You don't know their histories and details. All the things that make them who they are now. And you're the only one who feels that way. All the rest of them go to class and go to lunch like, oh, look at me, I've been doing this forever. I know you, and I know you, and time never stopped. And here I am. Yeah. Her eyes are large, and the lashes are long. The color of her eyes is this very clear light brown, like amber or whiskey. I'm having a hard time seeing the girl in the crane and this girl here. Even though the girl in front of me is big, she's much more delicate in person. She goes, do you ever wonder if it's everyone else who sees the world differently? Like, maybe you see people the way they're supposed to be seen. Identifiers. That's what I call it. Everyone has at least one thing that stands out. Is that why your hair's so big? My hair's big because it's so damn awesome, baby. She makes this sound, as if she doesn't quite believe it. And then she tilts her head to one side, scrunches up her forehead, and says, I feel like I know you. You know, from way back when. My pulse speeds up. It starts buzzing the way my phone is buzzing. I'm thinking, you don't know me. You don't know me. Like I have some power over her mind, and whatever happens, she cannot find out I was there that day she was rescued from her house. If she does find out, she might think I'm making fun of her because I saw her being rescued from her house. That this is why I grabbed her. She says, did you go to Westview Elementary? No, ma'am. Before I can say anything else, my phone buzzes again. Do you need to get that? Someone really wants to talk to you. They can wait. She's still studying me, but finally she shakes her head, as if she's clearing the slate. I'm having that I feel like I know you feeling a lot these days. You're in good company. Or maybe shitty company, depending on how you look at it. I smile. She almost does, but stops herself. With face blindness, I seem to constantly lose the people I love. She goes quiet for a second. I know what that's like. And walks away. I drive home and collect my little brother. And we scavenge the garage for robot materials. This is where I store the wreckage from all the creations I've built, and later taken apart. I say, hey little man, how was school today? Okay. Real okay or fake okay?
Somewhere in between.
Libby. I meet Rachel in the park. We sit on our usual bench and she says, so why did you punch him? Because I'm ready for my normal life. I just want to move forward like everyone else without being grabbed in cafeterias as if I'm some sort of prize heifer at a rodeo. I tell myself, this is the person you can say anything to. The person who knows you better than anyone. But all I come up with is, I was mad. And then I think of three more questions I want to ask Jack. The next afternoon, Mr. Levine is practicing free throws when we all walk into the gym. He says, you're here. Excellent. Kishan, Travis, Jack, and Libby, you'll be playing Natasha, Andy, Maddie, and me. Playing what? Basketball, Mr. Thornburg. And he throws the ball to Kishan, who catches it one-handed. Shouldn't it be all of us against Kishan? You know, and just to make it more even? Quiet up, Mass, and prepare to lose. Kishan sinks a basket from the door, which is no surprise. During the time Rip Van Libby was sleeping, he's become Mr. Basketball 3 years running. This isn't about winning or losing. It's not a competition. This is about teamwork. We all stare at Mr. Levine, who's doing this crazy back-and-forth shuffle dance, like he's in a boxing ring. Everyone in this room needs to learn how to play well, or at least better, with others. Of course, Kishan wins the tip-off. We run up and down the court, and except for him, we all suck, even the athletes among us. It's sad and embarrassing, really, and the only thing we're learning is how to humiliate ourselves in front of our peers. Every single time Kishan makes a basket, he acts like he's just won the state championship. He's barking orders at his team and dribbling behind his back and through his legs and making these impossible jump shots. And honestly, it's like playing against LeBron James if he were a 6'6" baby. At some point, Mr. Levine grabs the ball from him and says, "This is not Kishan hour. It's about helping out your teammates. It's about we're all equal. It's about pulling together." He sinks a perfect three-pointer. "Take a timeout, Mr. Basketball." "What?" "You can sit on the bleachers for a few minutes. It's not going to kill you." "Man." Kishan goes dragging off, the slowest human on earth. We wait for him to leave the court. And 2 years later, he finally sits down. Natasha rolls her eyes, shakes her head at the ceiling. Mr. Levine says, "If it'll make you feel better, I'll sit out too. Even numbers. Whatever's best for the group, right, Kishan?" Kishan looks at him, then past him at Natasha, who raises a single eyebrow. He says to Mr. Levine, "Sure." So now we're 3-3. We keep the lead until Jack passes the ball to Andy, who's on the other side. After Andy shoots and scores, Kishan is on his feet. "WTF, Mass!" Only he doesn't spell it out. And he shouts it. Mr. Levine says to him, "Language!" At the same time, Jack mumbles something about the ball slipping. When it happens again, I think Kishan's going to lose it. Jack says, "Hey man, just trying to do my civic duty." Andy goes, "What does that mean?" Jack shrugs, does this kind of cocky half-smile. "I'm just saying it looked like your team could use some help." Andy throws the ball at him, a little too hard. Now they're having some sort of standoff, bristling at each other like two cats in an alley. "Why don't you keep the ball, Maslin? I'll get it back in about 60 seconds. Mr. Levine goes, "Enough, both of you. Jack, stop wasting time." For the next few minutes, Andy and Jack are each trying to win the game single-handedly. Andy is shouting at Natasha and Maddie, and Jack isn't even passing anymore, just moving the ball from one end of the court to the other and taking every shot. Until Natasha gets him cornered and Jack has to get rid of the ball. To Andy. Again. The following 30 seconds go like this. Andy does a layup and walks by Jack, ramming him in the shoulder. Jack says, all sarcastic, "You're welcome." Andy gets in his face like he wants to take a swing. Jack stands there like he wants Andy to punch him. Mr. Levine gets in between them and rattles off this speech about getting along and playing out our feelings. That's the moment I look at Jack. And he looks at me. And I know what's going on here. He's getting Andy confused with Travis. Same build, same height, same hair, same color shirt. I try to imagine that Andy and Travis are strangers to me, that I'm face blind, that every time I look at them and then look away, I have to put them back together. I tell myself, "Let it be, Libs. Let nature do what it's going to do. After all, doesn't he deserve to be shamed in front of not only these people, but all people everywhere?" And now we're playing again, and suddenly I'm yelling at Jack, "Hey, pass it to me!" Even though I am the worst shot in this room, maybe in the world. But instead of passing me the ball, he drives down the court himself. The next time he gets the ball, I jump up and down and wave my arms in his direction. "I'm wide open over here!" He shoots me this look and I think, fine if you don't want my help. But then he's called on a foul. We stand next to each other watching Maddie shoot free throws and I say, just give me the damn ball before Mr. Levine makes us stay an extra hour. A minute or so later, Jack throws me the ball. As I start to dribble, Maddie steals it away. But when he throws it to me the next time, I aim for the basket. By some miracle, I make it.
Jack. I hold the door open as everyone files out into the parking lot. We won by 13 points, and Kishan is carrying Natasha like she's his NBA trophy. As Libby brushes past, I think of Sunshine. It's her shampoo or her soap, or maybe it's just her. I think, did she smell like Sunshine before she was cut out of her house? Or did this come after, once she was back out in the world? She looks up at me and says, "You should really tell someone what's going on with you." I already did. I'm irritated because now here's this girl saving my ass. Like I am a person in need of saving, which apparently I am. Someone other than me. It's not like you're the only one who has this. I know that may be what it feels like to you, but statistically it's not that rare. At least it's not as rare as being so super fat you got stuck in your house. Have you been on the Prosopagnosia Research Center site? Because they have this wallet card you can carry with you and give to people to explain what you have. I'm not saying that's the answer, but maybe it's a start. I call Caroline as I'm driving away. Hey, beautiful. Come over. I can't. What do you mean you can't? I've got work. Later then. I'm busy tonight. I'll take you out tomorrow night. We'll do it up big. We'll paint the town, a night you'll never forget. What are you busy with? Or should I ask who? I'm building Dusty's Christmas present. It's September. I'm building it. She goes completely quiet. Caroline? Babe? I wish you'd never grab that girl, that Libby Strout. Believe me, that makes two of us. I like to think I'm above that kind of shitty behavior, so you can imagine how disillusioning it's been for me. All this detention time is eating into us time. It's beginning to ruin my life. I want to say, can you put Nice Caroline on the phone? But instead I say, sorry, babe. I promise I'll make it up to you.
Libby. My dad and I are driving home on National Road, heading past the college, when this wave comes over me, and I feel the hollow in my heart that's been there ever since my mom died. Loss does that. Hits you out of the blue. You can be in the car or in class or at the movies laughing and having a good time. And suddenly, it's as if someone has reached directly into the wound and squeezed with all their might. I can see my dad and me driving home, this same direction that night we lost her. We pass us on the road, and I can see our faces through the windshield. We are ghosts. I look at my dad now, and he glances at me. What is it, Libs? I almost say it. It's her. Always. It's the suddenness of life changing in an instant that makes me anxious when I sleep. And makes me tell myself to breathe when I'm awake. It's nothing. I lay my fingers on my wrist so that it looks like my hands are just resting on my lap when what I'm doing is checking my pulse. Breathe. Stay steady. No reason to get worked up. It was nice of Bailey to come over. She was always a sweet girl. She is. You know, you can have friends over to the house anytime you want. So can you. Mom wouldn't want you to be alone. I can almost hear her. Give me a respectable mourning period, Will, but don't stop living your life. I'm not alone. He gives me this crazy-looking grin. I won't be here forever. No one ever is. I'm good. I don't fully believe him, though. And then I decide to let both of us off the hook. Have you ever heard of face blindness? Face blindness? Prosopagnosia. It's when you can't tell faces apart, so you don't recognize your family or friends.
Is this for a school project?
Jack Maslin asked me not to tell, and against my better judgment, I intend to honor that. Yes, I say.
Jack. Instead of checking inventory or filling orders, I sit at the Maslin's office computer and search for prosopagnosia research centers. The site says they're located at Dartmouth, Harvard, and University College London, headed by a man named Brad Duchesne. I've heard of it, and him, but I've never really explored the site. So I spend some time on there, reading more about this thing I almost definitely, for sure, have. Not surprisingly, prosopagnosia can create serious social problems. Reports of prosopagnosia date back to antiquity. One of the telltale signs of prosopagnosia is great reliance on non-facial information, such as hair, gait, clothing, voice. Most of this I know by now. I visit a few of the links to Face to Face, the biannual newsletter, and then I take the Famous Faces test, which tests my ability to recognize celebrities. The president, Madonna, Oprah. Even though I've taken tests like this before, the only one I get right is Martin Luther King Jr. And that's just because I guess. I click on the contact page. If you believe that you are prosopagnosic or have other types of recognition impairments and are interested in becoming involved with research, please contact us using our form. We will try to get you involved with studies that we are conducting, or we can put you in contact with researchers in your area. I open the email client, and it's logged into my dad's account. There, right there, where anyone can see it, is a new unopened email from Monica Chapman, sent 11 minutes ago, while I was sitting here researching my damaged brain. Subject: Re-Jack. As in me. As in my dad and Monica Chapman are in some way discussing me. I stare at the subject line, at her name, at my dad's name, at my name. If I open it, here's what will happen. I'll know more than I already do, which means I'll only be adding to the secrets I'm already carrying around. And then I open it, and wish I hadn't. I saw Jack, and he seems so angry. Has he ever talked to anyone? I know he's got Levine after school, but maybe you should think about getting him some one-on-one help. I can suggest somebody. The counselors here are actually pretty good, but I know other ones as well. We'll figure this out. You don't need to do it on your own. I love you. M. I look down and my hands are shaking. I wait to spontaneously combust, like Knight Polonus Vorstius of Italy, who burst into flame after drinking too much wine. When I don't, I write, "Dear M, if Jack is angry, it's because of you and us. The only thing that's going to help him is removing us completely. Maybe I should stop being so selfish. If I really loved you, I would end my marriage, or at least come clean to my wife. I owe her that. Maybe I owe you that too. Maybe our love is the biggest love there's ever been, although I doubt it. But whatever. I just need to stop being such a pussy. No wonder he's so angry. Love, N." I don't send it, but I leave it open for my dad to see. I do a search for books on prosopagnosia and the brain, and I order every one of them, charging his credit card. I sign into my email account and write a letter to Brad Duchesne. My name is Jack. I'm a high school senior, and I'm almost positive I'm face blind. I'm not sure how much longer I can keep this up. Everyone in my life is a stranger, and that includes me. Please help. I send it and immediately want to take it back. But now it's out there. So all I can do is wait and hope that maybe, just maybe, this man can tell me what to do.
Libby. I still have the copy of We Have Always Lived in the Castle that some good Samaritan sent to the hospital. I keep it on the little table beside my bed and use the letter that was sent with it as a bookmark. I want you to know I'm rooting for you. Sometimes we need to hear that, even from a stranger. I think of all the people I'm rooting for, my dad, Rachel, Bailey, Iris, JV, Mr. Levine, Principal Wasserman, Mr. Dominguez, my classmates in the conversation circle, maybe even Jack. And then I get out my damsel's application, read it through to make sure I've answered every question and filled out every line, tuck it neatly into my backpack, and dance.
Jack. During dinner, no one really talks except Dusty, who wants to audition for his school's production of Peter Pan. Marcus is screwing around with his phone under the table, and Mom's not even yelling at him. I'm too busy pretending we're all friends here, and I don't want to knuckle punch my own father. And he's too busy pretending. Mistress? What mistress? He finds me later in the bathroom when I'm brushing my teeth. He walks in and says, very low, "You shouldn't have gone into my email. I'm sorry you saw what you thought you saw, but there's the matter of respecting my privacy. There's more to it than you know, so what you read there, it's out of context. But I'm sorry." He says it nicely, because Nate Maslin is a nice guy. And it's important for him to be liked, especially post-cancer. I can tell he's waiting for me to forgive him and move on the way everyone else does, and that pisses me off. I take my time brushing, rinsing, wiping my mouth on a towel. Finally, I look at him. I'm taller than he is by a good inch, not counting my lion fro. I say, "You can't use cancer as an excuse for shittiness anymore." And of course, I'm talking to me too. Although he doesn't know that. I dream that I'm flying from airport to airport, and each one is mobbed with people. So mobbed, I can't breathe or move, and every face is blank. No nose, mouth, eyes, eyebrows. I'm searching for someone I know, for anyone who looks familiar, and the more I search, the more my chest tightens and the less I can breathe. But then I see her. Libby Strout. She's lowered from the ceiling by a crane, larger than life. Larger than anyone. And she's the only one with a face.
Saturday.
Jack. The locker room is enormous. It smells like feet and piss. Or like Travis Kearns, whose main identifier is the fact that he sometimes reeks like a skunk because of all the weed he smokes. It's pretty much the last place you want to spend a Saturday. But here we are, the seven of us and Mr. Sweeney. Enormous belly, mullet, sideburns, slight limp. We spread out, and I purposely take a corner by myself because I don't want to talk to anyone. At noon, we break for lunch. Sweeney gives us 45 minutes to eat outside on the bleachers we'll be painting next weekend. And I take a seat away from everyone else. The bleachers are old and weather-worn, and just the sight of them makes me lose my appetite. Painting these bleachers is one more thing added to the shit pile that is my life. I pop the top of my soda and close my eyes. The sun feels good. "Soak it in, brave soldier," I tell myself, "while you can." I almost drift off, but I hear someone yelling, "Leave me alone!" over and over. And it's a voice I recognize, bellowing and foghorn-like. I open my eyes and see a big guy lumbering past the school. And there's this group of guys following him. They're all around my age, white, kind of interchangeable. I don't recognize any of them, but the foghorn voice sounds like it belongs to Johnny Rumsford. I've known Johnny since kindergarten. Back when he was just Rum for short. He was always bigger than everyone else, a kind of gentle giant. For as long as I've known him, kids have been following Rum around, heckling him for being a little slow, a little simple, a little clumsy. Like a pack of hyenas targeting a buffalo. I'm watching these guys now, and they're yelling stuff at him, even though I can't hear what. The boy who may be Rum's shoulders are all hunched up, like he's trying to pull his head into his neck, or maybe right down into his chest. And then one of the guys throws something at him, and hits him on the back of the head. Suddenly, I'm seeing myself like everyone else does. I'm one of those heckling, yelling hyena kids, throwing things at people who don't deserve it. I set my sandwich down, and I take off like I'm being launched to the moon. At first, may not be Rum thinks I'm running straight for him, and he freezes, clearly terrified. The guys are laughing and throwing shit, rocks, trash, anything they can find. And I run right into the herd of them. They don't even have time to think. One lands on his ass in the dirt, and suddenly they're not laughing anymore. Did he do anything to you? I point at Rum. Did he? What the hell, Mass? Of course they know me. I'm probably friends with these scumbags. Tell me one thing he did to you. One of the guys gets up in my face, and he's as tall as I am and wider by a couple of feet. But I don't back down because I'm at least three heads angrier. Seriously, Mass, you're gonna give us shit? What did that fat girl do to you, huh? Tell me one thing she did. Another guy goes, yeah, how's attention, jackass? I don't think, I act. Maybe because I'm angry. At everyone. At myself. I feel like I could take on the whole world right now. I say to Rum, go home, Johnny. Get out of here. And then I turn around and punch the first guy I see. He drops to the ground and another one comes at me, and I haul off and punch him too. Even when my hand feels broken, even when I can't feel my knuckles anymore, I keep pounding on these guys. And at some point, it's as if I leave my body on the ground and float up into the sky, where I watch the fight like it's happening to someone else. Some part of me thinks, what if that's it? What if whatever malfunction in my brain that's causing this face blindness is spreading, so that I can't even recognize where I am or what I'm doing? What if my brain is completely broken and I never get back down there to me again? I'm not sure how much time passes, but at some point I'm aware of something or someone tugging at my arm. I turn around and I'm on the ground again. And it's Libby Strout. She's yanking me back. One of the guys says to Libby, don't hurt me, Flabby Stout! Don't hurt me! He pretend cringes, his hands up in front of his face. She goes, don't call me that. What's that, Flabby? I say, I know you're not talking to her. All cool and collected. She knows who I'm talking to. And I don't like the way he says it, so I punch him. Then this tall black guy with a smooth shaved head is there, and he's glaring at the herd of hyenas. You better run. My boy here, he's gonna kill you, and if he don't, I will. This can only be Kishan Price. Those boys go walking away, and the guy who must be Kishan stands watching them. Son, you're as stupid as you look. He's staring at me. What do you think Sweeney would have done if he saw you?
He's inside. He didn't see. Come on.
Libby pulls me toward the bleachers.
Your lip, she says. It's bleeding again.
But I don't even remember getting hit. I look back toward the street, and Rum is wandering across the bridge that I know will take him home.
Libby. We've got 15 minutes left of lunch, and Jack Maslin drops onto the bleachers, lip bleeding onto his shirt. As he stares off into the tree line, I'm watching him, trying to put myself in his skin again. I think about going home and what it would be like if my dad walked in and I couldn't recognize him. Or if my mom miraculously came back from the dead and I didn't know it was her. If I'm putting myself in the skin of Jack Maslin, I'm feeling pretty lonely. And maybe scared. How would I know who to trust? I sit down beside him and say, "It's Libby again," even though I probably don't need to because it's pretty obvious in this group, even to someone with face blindness. He's staring out at the street like he's itching for another fight. The blood is dripping down his chin and onto his shirt, and he's not doing anything to wipe it away. I hand him a napkin. "No thanks. Take it. You don't want Sweeney to see." He swipes at his chin with the napkin, winces a little, and then holds his soda can against it like an ice pack. He cocks an eye at me.
"Was that about me?"
"What?"
"Flabby Stout. Did I do that? With the rodeo? I want to know exactly how shitty I should feel right now."
"That wasn't about you. That was about Moses Hunt being Moses Hunt. The exact same Moses Hunt he was in fifth grade."
"Moses Hunt. Great."
The Hunt brothers are as notorious as the James Gang. There are at least 5 of them, maybe more, because their parents just breed and breed. Age-wise, Moses falls somewhere toward the bottom, although he looks 40 thanks to all the hard living, the missing teeth, and the fact that he's so mean. Jack says,
"Are you okay?"
"We just have history. Part of me wishes I'd let you kill him, but otherwise, yes. I'm okay." Rattled, but okay. Heart pounding, chest clenching, but okay. "Thanks for standing up for me." Jack shakes his head and stares off toward the street again. We sit there a minute, Jack watching the street, me watching him. Finally, I say, "If you're not careful, you're going to run into someone angrier than you."
"I doubt that person exists."
And this isn't charming Jack Maslin. This is a boy who is burdened by life. I make myself sit there, inside his skin. I do it for Atticus. And for my mom. "If you're not careful, you'll eat too much and get stuck in your house. Trust me. You think no one understands and you're alone and that makes you angrier and why don't they see it? Why doesn't someone say, 'Hey, you seem burdened by the world. Let me take that burden for a while so you don't have to carry it around all the time.' But it's on you to speak up." And then I shout, "Speak up if you've got something to say." The other delinquents turn and stare at me, and I wave.
"You're a very wise woman."
"I am, actually. You'd be amazed. But I've had a lot of time to read and watch talk shows and think. A lot. So much time to think. Sometimes all I did all day was just wander around in my mind."
"So what makes you angry?"
"Stupid people. Fake people. Mean people. My thighs. You. Death. Gym class. I worry about dying all the time, like, all the time." He shifts the can so he can see me better. "My mom died when I was 10. She got up that morning like it was any other morning, and I went to school, and my dad went to work, and I only told her I loved her because she said it first. She drove herself to the hospital. She was feeling dizzy. By the time she got there, she wasn't feeling dizzy anymore. But the doctors ordered some tests anyway." He sets the soda can down but doesn't say a word. One minute she was talking to them, and the next minute she wasn't. It all happened in an instant. "Conscious?" I snap my fingers. "Unconscious." The doctor said the thing that caused it was a cerebral hemorrhage in the right hemisphere of her brain. Something just burst.
"Like an aneurysm?"
"Kind of. I was pulled out of assembly and my dad came to get me. We went to the hospital so I could say goodbye. My dad had to tell them to turn off the machines, and half an hour later, she died. One of the nurses said to me, 'It can run in families.' So I was convinced it was going to happen to me. It still might." I check in with my heart rate. "Yes, it seems okay." I went to bed that night thinking, "Last night she was here. This morning she was here. Now she's gone. and not for a few days, but forever. How can something so final happen in an instant? No preparation, no warning, no chance to do all the things you plan to do. No chance to say goodbye. His eyebrows are drawn together in a V, and he's looking at me like he can see straight into my heart and soul. Now you're the only one who knows something about me. I'm sorry about your mom. I'm sorry too. I stare at my lunch and realize I'm not hungry. In olden times, I would have eaten every last bite because it was in front of me. I think that makes us even.
Does it?
You're not punching me, if that's what you're thinking. He laughs.
It's not.
In a minute, he goes,
"What do your shoes say?"
I hold my leg out to show him. Just quotes I like from books. He points at the most recent one, written in purple marker, the one that says, "More weight."
Where have I heard that?
Giles Corey, from The Crucible.
He was the last person put to death in the Salem witch trials. Those were his final words, a kind of FU to the people who were pressing him to death with stones. Mr. Sweeney appears and yells for us to get back inside. As we're collecting our trash and walking toward the doors, Jack goes,
"Moses and who else?"
"The ones bullying Johnny Rumsford?" He nods. "His brother Malcolm and also Reed Young."
"Malcolm?"
Now I nod.
"Shit, he's the meanest of them all."
I think the other two must be seniors.
"Thanks."
He shoves his hands in his pockets. "You're welcome." The light catches his wild, wild hair and holds it. And wham! Suddenly, just like that, I'm completely conscious of his guyness next to me. His long legs, the way he walks, fluid, easy, like he's made to walk through water. But at the same time with purpose, which makes him seem taller than he is, there aren't a lot of guys my age who walk like this, with swagger. It's as if I've suddenly discovered he's male. My face is hot and my back is damp and I'm thinking about Pauline Potter sexing off all that weight and I'm staring at his hands and I'm like, "Stop staring at his hands! What are you doing? He's the enemy!" Well, maybe not the enemy, but you are absolutely not going to think of him like that. I realize he's talking, and so I come zinging back to attention. He's saying,
"I want you, Libby Strout. I've always wanted you. It's the reason I grabbed you."
Or maybe he's actually saying, "You can't tell, but I'm smiling on the inside." I say, "I'm smiling back." I try to keep my face a blank, even though I don't have a split lip. But I can't help it. For some reason, I smile so everyone can see.
Jack. It's midnight when I walk Caroline to her door. On the step, I grab her by her waist and pull her in. And her body is rigid, like she's made of broom handles and marble. I want to ask her what it is that makes her like this, all uptight and controlling and mean. I wonder where geeky Caroline is right now. If the other day was real or a fluke, and this newer, shinier Caroline has really swallowed her whole. Is there anyone in there? I want to say. Instead, I pull her in tighter and wrap both arms around her and try to squeeze geeky, awkward, nice Caroline out of there.
"Ow!" she says. "You always do that too hard."
She pushes me off her. People might like her more if she didn't have such a chip on her shoulder.
Who?
Libby Strout. She has been talking about Libby all night. At dinner, during the movie, on the ride home. I laugh because, coming from Caroline, this is hilarious.
Why is that funny?
It's not. But you know. Pot. Kettle.
No, I don't know.
She crosses her arms.
Tell me more.
Smooth it over. Tell her what she wants to hear. But I don't, because suddenly I can't do it anymore. She's exhausting, and I'm exhausting, and we're exhausting. I've been telling her what she wants to hear for the past 4 years. I say, you know what? I'll talk to you later.
If you walk away, Jack, don't come back. You don't get to do that and come back.
Thanks. Got it. I feel this weird nervous energy. Like I'm doing something big and life-altering. I tell myself, you need her, as I get back into the Land Rover and drive away. I head straight to the scrapyard, where I jump the fence and wander through. And no one bothers me because it's late and dark, and I'm the only one here. It's amazing what you can find. Old license plates, old screws, a metal bumper. For me, the greatest item of all is gears. Whether they're small or big, it doesn't matter. Gears are like the power source for almost all machines, the thing that decides their force and speed. I dig for a while, and it's peaceful. Like I'm the only living soul for miles. But my mind's not in it. My heart's not in it. Too much of my life feels like this already. Trying to recycle something old into something new and better. Disguising someone else's trash as some fresh, shiny thing. In the driveway of my house, I pull out my phone. 13 texts and one voicemail from Caroline, sent over the past hour. A text from Cam, another from Seth. I open my email and wait for it to load. I'm thinking about Libby Strout when I see it. The email, delivered at 6:35 p.m. A reply from Brad Duchesne of the Prosopagnosia Research Centers at Dartmouth.
Monday. Libby. Before first period, Heather Alpern and the damsels are running drills on the football field. I stand on the sidelines and watch them, and I can't move because there they are. I'm starstruck. The damsels are 65 years old this year. They were originally created by two students who loved to dance, and the first ever team was made up of 20 girls. They wore skirts to their knees, which some people found shocking, and white gloves, and they performed with pom-poms and flags. Now there are 40 members, 39 without Terry Collins. At the end of the school year, everyone in Amos will turn out for the Damsels Showcase, which is held in Civic Auditorium, the town's performing arts center. And I want to be on that stage. I'm in a good mood until third period. After all, I have faced Moses Hunt without the sky falling. I've made up my mind to be a damsel, and I've walked around in Jack Maslin's skin and been, yes, the bigger person. I'm practically whistling as I go to my locker. Iris follows me, wanting to know why I'm so happy. And then, I open the door. The letters fall out like confetti. They are everywhere, across the hallway like a carpet. People are trampling them as they pass, and I'm on my knees trying to collect them before anyone can see them and connect them with me. Iris bends over, helping me. She opens one up and reads, "You aren't wanted." She opens another. "You aren't wanted." I grab the letters from her so she won't stand there reading every single one. There must be 100 of them. "Are these for you?" "That's my guess, Nancy Drew." Who would do this? But I know it's rhetorical because Iris Engelbrecht, more than anyone else, knows what people are capable of. When I don't answer, she says in her matter-of-fact Eeyore voice, "You need to tell someone. Take them to the principal. Come on. I'll go with you. Let's go right now. They can write us a pass for next period." I'm stuffing the letters into my backpack. I'm not going to the principal with this. And I sound as hurt, angry, and upset as I feel. "Weren't you the one who told me to be brave?" "I never told you to be brave." "You told me if I didn't speak up, Dave Kaminsky would think he could go on doing things like that to me." "This is different." "No, it's not. You have to let them see they can't do this to you. Let's go." I can feel the fluttering in my heart start to steady itself. This is another effect Iris has on a person. She's the human equivalent of Valium. I slam the locker door closed, shoulder my backpack, and start walking, the weight of all those letters drilling me into the ground. Iris trudges along behind me, still talking. Okay, I get it. I guess you can look on the bright side instead. It won't last forever. Eventually they'll find someone else to focus on, and then this whole fat girl rodeo thing will be forgotten. As if on cue, a group of boys goes by hollering in my direction. Things like, "Saddle up, fellas! Who wants a turn?" "Bastards!" This is from Iris, because instead of speaking, I'm doing the thing I used to do when I was younger, trying to will myself small, as if by concentrating really, really hard, I might start shrinking until I'm the same size as everyone else. An acceptable size, whatever that is. One that won't make all other people feel so uncomfortable. Iris bumps my arm with hers as if she's trying to remind me she's there and I'm not alone, but for some reason it ticks me off. I never volunteered to be her savior and protector. I can't even protect myself. She starts singing the Cowardly Lion's If I Only Had the Nerve verse from The Wizard of Oz, and as irritating as it is, I have to admit she's got a really pretty singing voice. Bump, bump, bump. I stop walking. Why do you want to be my friend anyway? I talk right over her singing. Is it because I stood up for you that day? Is it because I make you feel less freakish by comparison? Or is it because when you're with me, everyone leaves you alone for once and focuses on me? Her eyes go wide, and then narrow, and Iris Engelbrecht is staring at me like she thinks I'm a bastard too. It's because when you're not being a jerk, like this, I like you. Because except for that jerkiness, you're who I want to be. And she walks away.
Beggars can't be choosers.
Kendra Wu crows as she strolls by with Caroline Luchamp. I stand there, my hand on the classroom door, and yell, "What's that supposed to mean?" They're still heading away from me, but Caroline turns to face me, as graceful walking backward as she is walking the regular way.
What she's trying to say is that you might not want to burn your bridges when you're standing on an island.
And then she smiles the meanest smile I've ever seen. In driver's ed, Mr. Dominguez says,
"Libby, whenever you want to join us."
"Sorry." I stop staring into space. Bailey passes me a note.
"Are you okay?"
Instead of answering, I sit there and pretend I'm paying attention. And even when Mr. Dominguez says,
"Next week, we're ready to start driving,"
the moment I've been waiting for all my short, sad life, it's like I'm sitting in another room, at another school, far, far away.
Jack. I'm in the bathroom after third period when two guys walk in. Both white, both nondescript, except that one is a fucking mountain and the other is about my height. They shut the door. This is bad news because for as long as I've been at MVB, that door has never been closed. "What's up?" I do the head nod, act casual. But even though I can't recognize their faces, I recognize the emotion. They're mad as hell. I saunter toward the exit, trying to look as carefree as one can in this particular situation, but the smaller one blocks my way.
"When you messed around with my girlfriend, I let it go. But when you jump me and my friends for no reason and try to beat the living shit out of us, you don't do that, man. You don't screw with the people I love." This tells me it's almost definitely, probably Reed Young. And that right there behind him is definitely, probably Moses Hunt. I'm feeling reckless enough to go, "So you're saying you love him?" I nod at Moses. And they both lunge for me. I can't afford another fight, so I duck, and probably Reed goes sprawling, while probably Moses ricochets into the wall. And then I throw open the door and I'm out of there. I don't run. Hell no. But I burn a path in the floor all the way down the hall. For as long as people have been around, we've relied on facial recognition for survival. Back in caveman times, whether a person lived or died could come down to being able to read a face. You had to know your enemy. And here I am, barely able to make it out alive from a high school bathroom.
Libby. Mr. Levine, electric blue bow tie, electric blue sneakers, is sitting on the risers waiting for us as we walk into the old gym. We take our usual seats, and after we have a chance to get settled, he bounces to his feet.
We're going to try something different, which is what he says every day.
So far, we've sung songs, run a kind of obstacle course, stopping at each station to talk about a specific feeling or ways in which we might change our behaviors, and performed a scene from a Star Trek episode about two enemies having to work together to survive. Mr. Levine calls these teen building exercises. But this time, he walks out of the gym. We wait. When Mr. Levine doesn't return, Travis Kearns says, "Can we leave?" And then, the gym goes dark, the only light coming from these narrow windows way up by the ceiling. A second later, the room starts spinning with these spiraling globes of light, pink, orange, green, yellow, blue. It's what I imagine a European disco was like back in the 1970s.
What the?
But Travis doesn't finish because a song booms out over the speaker system so loud I almost cover my ears. It's the sappiest 80s ballad you've ever heard, and all that's missing is a DJ and a corsage pinned to my shirt. Mr. Levine comes back in and says, "On your feet!" He waves his hands like he's some sort of conductor and we're his orchestra.
Up, up, time's a-wasting. Let's work on building that self-esteem.
One by one, we stand. Kushan and Natasha kind of jokingly start slow dancing. When they stop, Mr. Levine says,
"Keep going." "Yes, it's really that simple. Now the rest of you."
Travis Kearns asks Maddie, who's pretty but shy. She stares at her feet the whole time. Even though there aren't enough girls to go around, no one asks me. Andy Thornburg starts waltzing with an invisible partner because dancing alone is apparently better than dancing with me. My chest flutters, the first sign of panic. Mr. Levine says,
"Ask her to dance, Jack."
"What?"
"You heard me."
Jack looks at me and I look at him.
"Before the song ends, please."
We keep standing there, and now my palms are damp, the second sign of panic. The next thing will be this strange compression in my chest and head as if I'm being squeezed by a giant boa constrictor. Gradually, everything will grow dim and distant, and I'll shrink until I'm a regular size person, and then keep shrinking until I'm small enough to squash under someone's shoe. Finally, Mr. Levine pulls out this remote and clicks it, and the song starts over. Everyone groans.
"I can do this all day. My phone is fully charged, and there are a lot more songs just like this on there. Worse ones, even."
I look at Jack, and he looks at me. And the lights are flashing across his face, turning his eyes green, brown, blue, gold, like he's a chameleon changing colors. He offers his hand. I take it. Because we have to. This is not the way I imagined my first school dance. We fumble our hands together and stand as far apart as possible, like someone's holding a ruler, more like a yardstick, between us. We shuffle back and forth as if we're both made of wood, staring at the ceiling, the floor, the walls, the other kids, anywhere but at each other. The song only gets cheesier as it goes on, and the lights are swirling and strobing, and his eyes are flashing green, brown, blue, gold, and suddenly I'm thinking about my palms, like how sweaty they are. I can just hear Jack Maslin going back to his friends, telling them all about my sweaty palms and what it was like to dance with the fat girl.
Jack says, "This may scare me off school dances forever." My first instinct is that he's talking about me, or maybe my damp hands, so I go, "Well, I'm not exactly having the time of my life." "I didn't mean you're scaring me off, although you're kind of scaring me off now." "Sorry." As I realize he means the song, and the lights, and Mr. Levine standing there like the world's most attentive chaperone. We're now kind of swaying, and it's not so bad. It's the first time we've touched where I wasn't either punching him or stopping him from punching someone. I say, "This is my first school dance." "Ah. Well, it's the closest I've ever come, at least. Not to put any pressure on you."
"No pressure. Just extreme performance anxiety. Every guy's dream."
"You're not a terrible dancer."
"My confidence is soaring now."
"It's just not exactly how I pictured it."
"Okay. So, what can I do to change that?" "You look really pretty tonight."
In the second it takes me to realize he's playing, my legs grow into the floor like roots. Jack tightens his grip on me and kind of nudges me into motion again. He says,
"Especially in that dress. The color really brings out your eyes."
Think. The sales clerk called it Hershey Brown.
Ugh,
what?
Actually, more like amber.
And he's looking into my eyes as if I'm the only thing he sees. I tell myself, he's such a good actor, as these little goosebumps spring out at the base of my spine and go shooting up my back, across my shoulders, and down both arms. Suddenly, we're dancing closer, and I'm aware of not just his hands, but each individual finger connecting to my body and his legs bumping against mine. I want to lean in and get a whiff of him and rest my head on his shoulder, or maybe make out with his neck. Afterward, he'll walk me home and kiss me on the doorstep, sweet at first, and then hungrier and hungrier till we fall into the bushes and go rolling off across the yard. All at once, the song ends and a fast song begins, and my eyes fly open. We immediately break apart, and Jack wipes his hands on his jeans. Ech! Mr. Levine goes,
"Don't stop! It's a dance-off! Go, go, go!"
And he's dancing like a crazy man. For a moment, all we can do is gawp at him. I mean, it's a spectacle! The man is all legs and arms and flopping hair.
"The longer you don't dance, the longer we're here. I'm getting at least 3 songs out of you."
And he starts it over. Jack Maslin goes, "Shit," and then begins to move. Of course, I think. Of course he can dance. Because he's their leader, they all start dancing. First Andy, and then Kishon, Natasha, Travis, and even Maddie. Jack Maslin is not my leader, so I'm still standing there. Once again, Mr. Levine starts the song over.
"I'm going to keep doing that till we're all moving."
It's one thing to twirl in the near-empty park with Rachel, but it's another to start shaking and jumping on school property in front of my counselor and my fellow classmates, delinquents though they may be. In that moment, my damsel's dream wavers because the audition will be so much worse. The audition means Heather Alpern and her squad captains, including Caroline Luchamp, sitting at a table, watching me. If I'm able to get past the potential humiliation of that moment, how will I ever perform in costume for the school? But this song, it's so... I realize I'm kind of tapping my foot and bouncing my head. No, I think. Libby, you can't. But the song is... Oh my God. I feel my hips start to move a little. No, 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 don't do it. But I'm alive. I'm here. We never know how long we have. We're never guaranteed tomorrow. I could die right now. Right here. It could be over in an instant. She woke up like it was any other day. Just like I did. Just like Dad did. We thought it was a regular, normal day. None of us knew we were waking up to the worst day. If we'd known, what would we have done? Would we have held on to her tight and tried to keep her here?
The song starts over. Kishan goes, "Come on, Libby. Damn."
What would Mom want me to do right now? If she could see me, what would she say?
And then, Jack Maslin is suddenly breaking out these moves. Kishan and Natasha are doing some sort of routine, and Mr. Levine is kicking his legs out like he's Heather Alpern, former Rockette. Even shy little Maddie is shaking her shoulders. Stay still.
Wait out the song. Don't you do it, Libby. But I can feel my body taking over my mind, and this is what happens. The dance is in me. All at once I'm in there, waving my arms, waving my booty, swinging my hair. I jump a little, and when the gym floor doesn't collapse, I jump some more. Jack starts jumping too, and before I can stop myself, I spin off into a twirl. Jack shouts, "What's that dance called?" I say the first name I think of, "The merry-go-round." I twirl and twirl. And then Mr. Levine is twirling, and Jack is twirling, and all the others are twirling.